This is the Politics and More podcast. I'm David Remnick. A new political weather has swept into Washington, D.C., and it's taken nearly everyone by surprise. Uncharismatic, aging, gaffe-prone, hyper-cautious, centrist Joe Biden has taken on an unlikely role, the leader of modern Rooseveltian liberalism. But back up a little bit. In the months before the election, the majority of the Democratic electorate was more or less united in its disdain for the Trump presidency. But what of the Democratic Party's nominee? Sure, Biden was preferable to the race-baiting neo-authoritarian in the White House, but who exactly was he? How would he lead? He lacked charisma, and in ideological terms, he was familiar, centrist, a Capitol Hill veteran with plenty of bad marks on his historical report card. And when he compared himself during the campaign to FDR and the potential of his presidency to the New Deal, who really took that seriously? Certainly not the left wing of the party that supported Bernie Sanders, and not too many others either. And yet in the first 100 days of his presidency, Joe Biden has not only taken on the pandemic with an orderly seriousness never seen at all in the Trump White House, he's also proposed a set of multi-trillion-dollar initiatives that bear comparison with the New Deal years. Infrastructure, in his view, is not just highways and bridges. It includes the future of the environment. It includes the education of our children. Goodbye the days of Bill Clinton saying the era of big government is over. Joe Biden may fail to win the votes he needs in Congress. He may run out of time and support. But he's waging a larger scale fight than almost anyone expected. Biden has set out to be a president of immense consequence. And maybe it's time we took that ambition seriously. Today, we're going to take a look at an unexpected political phenomenon, the return of big government liberalism and its unlikely tribune. We'll start with Susan Glasser. Susan writes our column, Letter from Biden's Washington. So help us understand the general mood in Washington right now. We know that Biden's proposals are broadly popular with everyday Americans, but votes on these bills are expected to fall strictly along party lines. What's the general feeling toward Biden in Congress now?
Well, I think you nailed it in terms of, you know, the grip of polarization, if you will, and of extreme partisanship, while it exists in the country, has taken hold even more so here in Washington for a variety of structural reasons, as well as personality reasons like the former president. But look, the reality is that it's breathtaking that they are pursuing an agenda this big and bold when you look at a 50-50 Senate. They are just one heart attack away from not being in control of the Senate. So the reality is that the window to act is short. The votes are not really there. And that's why any one individual member of the Senate has outsized power at this moment in time. You're going to read about Joe Manchin from West Virginia or Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona until you're sick of them, because the joke around Washington, right, is that Joe Manchin is the Senate majority leader. So I think that's just a reality that it's hard to square, frankly, with all the kind of slightly breathless comparisons between Joe Biden and FDR, between Joe Biden and LBJ, both of whom had significant, very large majorities in both the House and the Senate to pass their legislative agenda. And it's also a political switch, though. That's the thing that I most wanted to say to you today in this conversation, is that it's not so much that Democrats have changed who they are or changed their ideology. I think what they've changed is their political assessment of what works and what doesn't work in Washington right now, and what they're willing to go for and when.
During the debates, the Democratic Party debates, when Joe Biden would get a little misty-eyed about bipartisanship and reaching across the aisle and things like that, he was laughed at. He was called a sentimentalist at best. What is the state of bipartisanship and its feeling in the Democratic camp right now? How are they feeling about that?
I mean, first of all, I would like to say that to the extent he was seen as a kind of misty-eyed nostalgist in the Democratic Party, he won And the reason that he did is because he was seen, I think, correctly, Biden was by far the most electable Democrat. And there is a concern, and there's an ongoing, I think, political concern right now that Democrats tend to get so caught up in their kind of progressive fever dreams and their conversation with each other that what they're doing is ignoring the reality of a country in which 40% of Americans and the vast majority of Republican voters do not believe Joe Biden was legitimately elected president, that we are in the middle of an ongoing Democratic crisis as opposed to one that ended with the election of Joe Biden and some mandate that it's hard to see where that mandate came from to enact a progressive utopia in terms of legislation out of a 50-50 Senate. And so my fear is that right now we're continuing to see now the Democratic version of an alternate reality that in its own way might create as many political problems as the Trumpian Republican version of an alternate reality.
It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment.
Hey, can you hear me?
Hey, Jelani.
Okay.
It's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer and teaches at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Jelani, in his first 100 days, Biden's put forth three extremely ambitious pieces of legislation, the American Rescue Plan, the American Jobs Plan, and now the American Families Plan. Does the size and the scope of these plans seem at all recognizable coming from the Joe Biden that we've known for practically five decades of public life?
No, that doesn't really seem like the Biden that we knew or thought we knew. But at the same time, I think it's not necessarily that surprising because, you know, presidential platforms are basically best case scenario ideas. But nobody ever gets greeted by a best case scenario when they come into office. And so they wind up doing things that circumstances require, as opposed to things that the hypothetical version of this person would do. And so I think that it's not what we expect from Joe Biden. But maybe we were wrong to have expectations to think we knew what to expect from Joe Biden.
Now, Biden ran constantly reminding the electorate, the Democratic electorate at least, that he was Barack Obama's vice president over and over again. And I think not just because of the politics of race, but for to attach himself to all kinds of aspects of the Obama presidency. And yet they turn out to have radically different governing styles and different ambitions as well. What would you make of that?
So with Barack Obama, there was the kind of cautiousness and centrism that we associated with him. And it became, I think, a little bit more complicated because just being who he is, you know, he represented this much more insurgent movement, you know, the goals of the civil rights movement. But, you know, he was cautious. And then there were events that happened in the course of his presidency that reinforced that caution. The kind of Category 5 tempest that happened in response to the Affordable Care Act showed that they were not going to have a good time, an easy time getting anything through Congress. Joe Biden, I think, has a different situation. You know, they both came in after presidencies that people on the left and various parts of the left spectrum really despised. But Biden, I think, has not and been kind of caricatured in the way that Barack Obama was. Arguably, there's less to work with, you know, because Biden has such a long track record. He's been this avuncular figure in American politics, hewing toward the center of the political spectrum for decade after decade. Doesn't hurt that he's a white guy. And, you know, he is able, I think, to present these, his present, you know, version of his politics in a way that people find less alarming, even if they disagree with, you know, what he's doing or what he's saying.
You know, the fact is that, I'm not looking to punish anyone. But guess what? You know, I'm sick and tired of corporate America not paying their fair share.
John Cassidy writes for The New Yorker about politics and economics. John, our national debt now stands at $28 trillion. And Biden's proposals would add another $6 trillion to that. So Republicans are asking the question, how much is too much debt? How do we know when we've hit that mark?
Yeah, I mean, the question of affordability is obviously a big one. I mean, societies choose what they can afford. There's no sort of automatic number where you hit a debt number and then suddenly the economy collapses. So if the country takes a political decision that we'd like to spend on the environment, basically expanding the safety net, childcare, elderly care, etc., the money is there to do it. The question is, how do we raise it? Biden, very political, is saying we can do this by just raising taxes on the rich. You've got to distinguish between two things. The Relief Act, the Pandemic Relief Act, which was just passed, the $2 trillion Act, which Congress passed in March, that is a deficit-financed emergency relief package. It's best looked as a sort of disaster relief to get people through the end of the pandemic. Then there's Biden's policy agenda, the Big Build Back Better agenda, which is different and is in two parts, the infrastructure plan and the social infrastructure plan, childcare, etc. He's actually proposing to pay for those fully by raising taxes on the rich. So if you believe the administration's figures, they shouldn't raise the debt at all because there'll be higher spending on one side, but there'll be higher taxation on the other. So that's not a deficit-financed plan.
So in other words, if you start taxing people who earn more than $400,000 a year, a good deal more, that seems to be, first of all, very popular in the polls. And does that represent a shift in public opinion?
You don't need to be a political scientist to think that's going to be a popular program, because people are basically being told that they can have these very valuable and popular programs, but the rich will pay for them. From an economic perspective, the question is, is that feasible? Is there enough money at the top of the income distribution to make all these programs financeable purely by financing the rich over the long term?
What's the answer to that question?
Well, there is enough there to finance, certainly enough there to finance a great deal more spending. Whether they can finance it all, I think, is the debate that's going to be had over the next 6 months or so as this stuff gets pushed through Congress. I mean, I think what underlies all this really as well, which we haven't really talked about, is, you know, he's always seen himself as a sort of defender of the middle class and defender of unions, etc., even though he's been criticized from the right for supporting financial interests in his own state. I think it's all a sort of attempt to reassert democratic leadership on issues of economic populism.
Create jobs to modernize our bridges, our roads, our highways, our ports, our airports, our water pipes, our water projects, high-speed internet, transmission lines, and sustainable housing.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm okay.
Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard University and a staff writer. So Jill, I want to ask about the historical background to Biden's agenda. He has welcomed comparisons of himself and his plans to the New Deal and LBJ's Great Society. So how does this historical moment compare to those two, to the LBJ moment and the FDR moment, and their cases for big government?
I sometimes like to remember how LBJ wanted to call the Great Society the better deal. People said, wait, that doesn't sound good enough. Like, I think Biden wants to offer up the best deal. But I mean, if you think about the challenges that FDR and LBJ faced, there's not a one of them that Biden doesn't also have on the to-do list. So, you know, FDR was looking at the Great Depression and racial injustice in both eras, but that was certainly on very much a matter attended to by LBJ and the ways that he attempted to attend to it. But on top of all of those very dire circumstances, Biden has to contend with a global pandemic and an opposition party that doesn't recognize the legitimacy of his election. So we can look at bit by bit the legislative initiatives he's undertaking, and the scale of them is enormous and is exciting and challenging. But they can't address all of these problems confronting the nation and the world.
How would you compare the Great Depression and the economic situation that we're in now as a monumental challenge?
I think this is maybe less challenging than the Depression. I think the real difference, and to be honest, I myself don't find the FDR-LBJ comparison apt or really helpful historically, partly because I just don't think the president determines the course of events. So we don't have the same American people that we had in the 1930s or the 1960s. It's a completely different population. You can't like put FDR in it, you know, Doctor Who's phone booth and bring him to 2021 and he could address the American people, right? It's the constitutive population and the way that ordinary people face these struggles.
Well, how do they differ? How do the populations differ politically?
I think our spirit of endeavor is really different, for one thing. One of the ways in which FDR was successful was by communicating to Americans that we were in the same boat. And, you know, we can look back at that and say, you know, he totally threw Black Americans under the bus. Like, there's a lot of ways in which FDR fell completely short of that. Absolutely. But it is nevertheless the case that he was able to persuade Americans that they were in the same boat because Americans were persuadable on that point. And that is not, I don't think, how Americans feel today.
Jill, in some sense, Biden is trying to advertise himself as a third era in modern American politics, I would think. In other words, the era, the Rooseveltian era, which extended beyond him, and the Reagan era, which even encompassed in some ways Democratic presidencies as well. What stands in Biden's way?
That's a great question, because I do think he is right that we are ready for a remaking as a country. I think there's a real appetite for that among ordinary Americans. I think Biden is doing what needs to be done to do the work of governing, but he is not governing as a celebrity. And, you know, that really is a Reagan-era thing, right? Like Reagan collapsed together the highest political and most powerful office in the world with the glitz and glamour of Hollywood and the neediness of the Hollywood celebrity, which I think was carried on by Bill Clinton, by Barack Obama, is the defining feature of the Trump presidency. And I admire how wholly Biden has rejected that. But I worry that Americans are so accustomed to that, that they think that's how a president should be. Like, I am quite sure that Biden will not have a podcast with Bono after he leaves the presidency. He just has no appetite for that, right? That's just not, like, I think he wants to wield political power.
I remember at his first news conference, Biden said that the 21st century will be a battle between the utility of democracies and autocracies. And we've got to prove that democracy works. How does Biden go about doing that now?
Democracy has to work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think you can't, you know, it's like one of those things, like, you know, you see I see these bumper stickers all the time that say, trust the science. Like, I'm sorry, science isn't based on trust. Science is based on evidence and verifiability and reproducibility. So democracy is not based on trust either. It's just not. That's a fantasy, right? The democracy is based on proving its merits by providing a way of life that is fair and just and allows people to thrive. So right now we have, you know, what is it? 70% of Republicans don't even believe Biden is legitimately the president. That's not a problem he can solve. That's a problem ordinary Americans have to solve. I think he's doing his best by not trying to, like, that's a place where he's like, that's not me. Like, I got elected, now I'm going to govern. Like, that's what he has to do. It's up to the rest of us to make democracy work.
That's Jill Lepore. And we also heard from Susan Glasser, Jelani Cobb, and John Cassidy, all of them staff writers at The New Yorker.